The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, for $20 off your first purchase. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200.
Mike, the reason you're not moving up or you're not going anywhere here is because you're too urban, and we already got one of those. And I didn't know. Jesus. I really didn't know what the hell to say, to be honest with you. I mean, like, really? And I've never tried to be a black sportscaster. I just want to be a sportscaster who happens to be black.
Right.
But I want to keep my voice. As a black man with cholesterol issues and high blood pressure, I can't take it out there. I can't take it anymore, man. I need to stay on the West Coast where I'm going to die a peaceful death, my brother.
It could not have been more of a surprise, Richard. Maybe that speaks to my own naivete.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we talk to interesting people who work in the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week we have two really interesting guests. Our first guest is the FS1 host, Mike Hill. Call it FS1 now, not Fox Sports 1. Mike Hill is the host of America's Pregame. He's been in Fox Sports 1, or FS1, since August of 2013, came from ESPN, where he worked there for a decade. You probably saw Mike on SportsCenter, NFL Live, Baseball Tonight, co-hosted the Hill and Schlereth show. He's an interesting guy and an incredibly honest guy, and I wanted him on this podcast for that reason, because you ask him a question and he speaks his mind, and not everybody in the business does that, and I got a lot of respect for him. He's also a guy who's worked in a lot of local markets, from Hagerstown, Maryland, to Fresno, to Nashville, to Dallas. He was an Air Force reservist for a couple of years, born in the Bronx, I believe. So he's had an interesting broadcasting life, and we're going to talk to him about the differences between working at FS1 and working at ESPN, and I have no doubt he'll be honest about that. So Mike Hill of FS1 is our first guest, and then our second guest will end the podcast with Wayne Coffey, the longtime and exceptional Daily News writer. As many of you know, the Daily News a week ago, they laid off a ton of people in their sports department, maybe 12 to 15, essentially gutted that staff. It was one of the more horrible days in New York sports journalism. Wayne Coffey is one of the best at what he does. He's an incredibly brilliant long-form feature writer, just a terrific reporter. Not too long ago, broke the James Blake news in New York. So he's agreed to come on and talk about, I guess we'll sort of see what he's going to talk about in terms of the shock of leaving the Daily News, what he wants to do next, and what this business is like. And when someone at Wayne Coffey's level and with his exceptional qualities gets laid off, really very few people are safe. So I appreciate him coming on. I'm sure he hasn't talked to many people since that happened, and he should be interesting. So Mike Hill and Wayne Coffey, we're going to start off with Mike Hill, who I believe is somewhere in Los Angeles. And without further ado, Mike Hill from FS1. Okay, as promised, we bring in Mike Hill of Fox Sports and Fox Sports 1. We are talking to him. He is somewhere in the Los Angeles area, I imagine, looking at ocean, seaside, or something like that. Mike, thanks very much for joining the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be on with you, man, and it's a beautiful day outside in L.A., as it usually is, in Marina Del Rey. So, yes, I am enjoying life now. It's FS1 now, Rich.
That's FS1, right. I can't say Fox. Yeah, I can't say Fox Sports 1. I have to say FS1 now.
FS1, new branding. We got a new attitude. We got a new boss. We're happy over there.
Same old fun, brand new letters. That's very Fox.
Yes. Always fun.
Yeah, Marina Del Rey. It's not like Marina Del Rey here, Bette, as we are awaiting the Pope to come and traffic all over the place in beautiful New York City. All right, but anyway, let's move on to Mike Hill, because he is the reason we are all here. You know, Mike, one thing that's very interesting about your career, and as I said at the top, you've worked in local markets like Hagerstown and Fresno and Nashville. You worked for ESPN, so you worked on the East Coast for a decade. Now you're at FS1, so you're in Los Angeles. So you've had a real sense of different cultures at different places. But I think for this podcast, people will really be interested in what you see as the professional, cultural, psychic, however you want to describe it, differences between working for ESPN and working for Fox. So as general as you want to go, what are the differences between working for those two places?
Hey, man, I knew this was going to be like one of the first questions out of the box, man. I mean, you know what? The thing is, I can say it like this, Rich. The last 2 years of my life have been the best years of my life, period, both from a personal standpoint and a professional standpoint. The only thing that's missing are my two little girls on the East Coast who live in Maryland. But from a professional standpoint, being at FS1, working with the people I work with over there, the attitude, the personalities, the direction, the people that like to have fun but are still professional at the same time, it's just been wonderful. The difference is, in my opinion, and look, you know, I'm going to keep it real with you because you know I will. At ESPN, I didn't necessarily always feel that. And I'm not trying to dump on ESPN before anybody goes there. I'm not trying to sound like I'm bitter or anything like that. But the cultural difference is, to me, almost a complete 180. I'm not saying that it was all bad at ESPN because it wasn't. I'm just saying that it's so great at FS1 with the personalities and the energy and the positivity that we have inside that building. It's like a utopia. And I knock on wood because I know things can change. And I know ESPN couldn't be one of the greatest places on earth, and it could be a place where a lot of people like enjoy working. But as far as I'm concerned, for my personal experience, it's not really even much of a comparison, man, as far as like the cultural experience that I had at FS1 compared to ESPN.
All right, that's interesting, and I want to ask you a couple specifics about that. So can you give me a specific example of how you feel let's call it sort of creatively more free at FS1 than you would at ESPN?
Well, I mean, that's easy. I can be myself. I can really be myself. Now, look, I understand, and I can feel like I'm an adult. I know I'm a little edgy. I know there are a lot of people that feel like, you know, especially when I was at ESPN, that, you know, he'll go to the line. Yes, I'll go to the line, but I know when not to cross it. I know I'll never cross the line. You can't look at one point of my career, and I knock on wood once again, that I've ever actually crossed the line at ESPN. At FS1, the people that I have there, the people who are in my corner, the people that have my back, the bosses from Eric Shanks to Jamie Horowitz, all the way down to the CP, Scott Ackerson when he was there, they encouraged me to be myself. They want Mike Hill to be Mike Hill. Whatever that is, whatever my personality is, they want that to come out. And I've been given that freedom. And that's why you can see, and you can see the expression on my face and the happiness that I bring to the air. I've been told numerous times since I've been at FS1, Mike, you look happy. Yes, I look happy because I finally feel like I can do things and not have to worry about being called to the principal's office. At ESPN, I would do things, be a little edgy, but I would never cross the line. I've never done anything to cross the line. But I always felt like daddy was watching, or mama was watching, and I was going to be reprimanded if I said something wrong, which I never did. And I'm like, where's that coming from? When there are so many people who have been there, and I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, there have been so many people that are on air at ESPN who have crossed the line, and they were given second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth chances. And I never really felt like I got the first chance to really truly be myself. So I always felt like I had a tight leash on my neck. And that's no way for anybody who is an artist, who considers themselves an artist, or somebody who's creative to feel.
That's interesting, Mike. When you say edgy but not going over the line, are you talking about, let's say, commentary on players? You know that on this podcast I've had Jemele Hill on. I've had a lot of women on, and, you know, in terms of some of the elements that you're talking about, I think Jemele would probably say that there's a place that she could go, let's say, when she's talking about race, but probably can't go past that. There may be some women who would say there's some places I can go when talking about gender and, let's say, you know, sexual politics, but I can't go past that. So when you're talking about edginess on air, what are you specifically talking about? Are you talking about certain issues, or are you talking about things about certain athletes and teams?
No, I think just basically giving my commentary, just being an opinionist. And when it comes to race, when it comes to sex, when it comes to gender and things like that, I know my limitations. I know not to say stupid stuff, man. I'm not dumb. I mean, look, I'm a sportscaster, but I'm also very educated. I'm also a very smart person. And I know I'm not going to say anything that's going to try to offend somebody. But there have been times when, you know, I'll say things, say, for example, here's the difference. Off camera, there are certain things that I can say, that I will say, that my personality inside the newsroom, I will be that way. But I know not to take that fully on the air. Now, right. I'll still keep my personality. I'll still keep my enthusiasm. I'll still keep my who I am, and I'll take it on the air, and I'll try and convey that to the masses. But there are certain things that I know that I've said in the newsroom, which I know should still be a professional environment, but, you know, at ESPN or even at FS1, it's different because you're around a crowd of people and you're talking about certain things, maybe joking about things, that I know not to take on the air. I know I'm not going to destroy my career by saying something stupid. Now, I don't say things that are offensive, because I wouldn't offend anything that, you know, somebody in the newsroom that's listening, as well as I wouldn't offend anybody in the office. So it's not necessarily about gender or race, anything like that. I know those are topics where you've seen me on the air at FS1 or even at ESPN, where I've gone on there and I've told you how I felt about it. And I've said it, hopefully I've said it in a respectful manner, and I've said it in an educated manner that people can get something out of and being smart with it. But I always felt like some people at the other network kind of took my personality off air and felt like, oh, he's dangerous. He might take that on air, and I think that really held me back. As a matter of fact, I know it did, because I was told that several times when I was there. And also was told several times, and I'm not trying to come down too hard. Maybe I am sitting on your black couch right now. But I was told several times when I was there that, you know what, well, because you're urban. I was told this by a person who is in charge of the talent department. He said, like, Mike, the reason you're not moving up or you're not going anywhere here is because you're too urban, and we already got one of those. And I didn't know. Jesus. I really didn't know what the hell to say, to be honest with you. I mean, really? And this person was telling me, he was telling me this because he was about to retire. And I'm like, what the is this? Seriously? And I was in shock. And, of course, you know, people would deny things like that. But when you're told that, you're afraid to be yourself. You know, I've always had this, and rest his soul, and rest in peace, I've always had this this complex, because growing up, when I was, you know, coming up through the ranks, I've always been myself. I've always had this kind of street edge, this urban background, because I realized at an early age in my career that I couldn't be anybody else except myself. So Stuart Scott, you know what I'm talking about. Stuart right. Scott was already on the air at ESPN. Well, I was doing basically the same thing Stuart was doing when I was in Fresno, when I was in Hagerstown. If you look at the tapes, this was even before Stuart started at ESPN. But because Stuart was doing it on the national level, you know, of course he's going to get the accolades, and people look at me and say, well, you're trying to be like him. No, I'm just trying to be myself. So when I'm coming up through the ranks and I finally get to ESPN, and yes, I conform a little bit after going through a lot of transgressions and issues throughout my local career, finally get to ESPN, and yes, I want to still be who I am, but I also am very aware that I can't sound like Stuart, because one too many in some people's opinion. And so when I was told that by the talent person who was in charge of helping us to be better, it just kind of blew my mind, and I knew I was in trouble from then on. And that was like when I was my first year at ESPN, and I never really felt comfortable the entire time I was there. Now that I'm at FS1, I feel comfortable, and I really feel like I can be me.
All right, well,
if that makes any sense.
It does. And first of all, I appreciate you being honest and answering that. And let's cut any bullshit. Urban is a euphemism for black. Let's not pretend anything other than that. And it does it brings up a question. You know, when I put out on Twitter if anybody had any questions for you, a longtime follower of mine, it's a woman named Monica McNutt. She's a young black sportscaster and sports reporter for American Sports Network, played ball at Georgetown too. Really interesting woman and a reporter on the come. And one of the things she wanted to ask, and I think it probably relates to her as well, was how to balance between being true to yourself with whatever that means, lingo, language, culture, however you define that, versus whatever is conventional at your network. So it's clear that at FS1, you feel like you could be you. It's kind of amazing to me that you were told, essentially year one or two at ESPN, not to be you and to, I guess, conform to whatever I don't even know how to phrase it, like a generic ESPN sportscaster is supposed to be, like a non-color sportscaster, you know, like somewhere yeah. between white and black.
What's crazy is that, you know, what I've been kind of told, when I was in Hagerstown, I was allowed to do anything I wanted. They encouraged it in Fresno. They encouraged it in Nashville. When I got to New York, it kind of felt a little bit, okay, well, Mike, you might want to tone it down just a little bit and whatnot. And I've never tried to be a black sportscaster. I just want to be a sportscaster who happens to be black.
Right.
But I want to keep my voice. I don't want to sound like anybody else. I know where I grew up. I grew up in the street. I grew up in New York in the Bronx, moved down south to Alabama at the age of 18. You couldn't understand a thing I said. Seriously. And I know a lot of people still can't understand what I'm saying now, but I had to teach myself how to speak in order to get on television, because when I was 17 years old and I was telling people, I want to be a television sportscaster, people are like, yeah, right, you got to sound white. These are my friends. You got to sound white. You got to sound like this. And then there are other people who were professionals who told me, well, you got to learn how to enunciate your words. You know, your diction is terrible. So I taught myself when I was in the Air Force. I taught myself how to speak all over again, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So when I went through the ranks, and the day I got out of the military and I got my first job in Hagerstown, Maryland, it was the process, and it still is 20 years later. So when I finally get to New York and I'm kind of running into a couple of issues, not me, I started feeling, okay, well, they're trying to hold me back, or I didn't understand it in the beginning. I would talk to my mentor, like, you know what, they're telling me to do this. I want to do this. But he said, you know what, there comes a time and a place when you come to certain markets, certain aspects of your career where you're going to have to conform. You don't necessarily have to change who you are, but you have to conform. You got to know your audience, and you got to know what your bosses want. And that's what I started to learn. When I got to Dallas, after I left New York, I worked for a guy down at FAA, man, that it just didn't work out whatsoever, because he wanted a black face, but he didn't want a black sportscaster. He didn't want my language. He didn't want the words that were coming out of my mouth. And I've never been so-called, what do they call, ghetto or too black, whatever. I don't even know what the hell that means, to be quite honest. It fucking pisses me off when I hear that. You're too fucking black. Well, what the hell does that mean? You're too black. But I used to hear that. You're too black. You're too this. I'm like, you know what? Why can't I be a sportscaster who happens to be black that's not trying to sound like somebody else? And the irony in all of this is they would say something to me when I was at ESPN. Well, it'd be like, you know what? Well, you sound too much like Stu. Why don't you try and sound like John Saunders? I'm like, does that make sense? You're telling me not to sound. You're telling me not to sound like somebody else, but you want me to sound like somebody else. So you're saying we want you. It doesn't make sense to you, Richard, when somebody tells you,
right,
don't sound like somebody else, but sound like somebody else. You know what I mean? Be yourself. So sound like John Saunders. No,
yeah, well,
what
it comes off to me is that, first of all, Bette and I have been to the Bronx many times, you know, Mike, so we can understand you. We're 10 minutes away, basically. but what it sounds like to me is that at least the person you were talking to, or the talent department you were talking to, had an idea of John Saunders, what, quote-unquote, being an acceptable African-American broadcaster versus Stu Scott, who was, quote-unquote, urban, street, dangerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are all bullshit.
Or too much.
Yeah, these are all BS code words, as everybody pretty much who lives in reality knows.
Yeah, you know what? And I'm not naive enough to think that wasn't, but, you know, I can't prove it. So I'm not, like, once again, I will need to preface myself by saying I'm not trying to make any accusations.
Right, I understand.
This is just what I'm told. Now, people can jump to their own conclusions now. Wink, wink. You can feel what you want to. But, yes, to me, and I'm not saying being John Saunders was bad, because John Saunders is a hell of a broadcaster.
Absolutely.
He helped me out a lot. He pushed and promoted a lot of African-Americans and still does at ESPN. He's always been a mentor. But I'm just saying, I wasn't trying to sound like Stu, nor was I trying to sound like John Saunders. I'm just trying to be me. I just wanted to be me, and I just felt like when I was there, I could not be me. Now, look, and not just ESPN. Like in Dallas, I got fired by a guy at the ABC affiliate, Dale Hansen, down there, because I was there for a while, and I was gaining a following or whatever, and he always wanted me to sound like somebody that I wasn't. He asked me one time. He said, Mike, do you want to be a sportscaster or do you want to be a black sportscaster? Once again. And I said, Dale, I just want to be a sportscaster who happens to be black. Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to keep my voice. Is that okay? And it wasn't okay, and I got fired. So, you know, I've been dealing with it, man. So once again, like I said, since I've been here at FS1, and I knock on wood, hopefully nobody tried to tell me to change now, they just allowed me to be who I am, and I'm grateful for it.
Here's my last one on this topic, Mike, and then I want to get to America's pregame and get some just sort of specifics of how you prepare for this show and what this show is about. You know, you are now, given your tenure in the business, you would be a mentor, or if nothing else, a sounding board for a lot of young broadcasters of color, both men and women, who want to get into the business. From what you have heard, even anecdotally, are you still hearing that people are trying to change the voices of particularly young black men and women who are on the air? Or have things now gotten better in 2015 where there's an acknowledgement that, like, your voice, how you sound, what your cultural references are you, and, you know, the audience can sort of not only deal with that, but can embrace that because we're a more diverse country to start with?
Yeah, I think that's the exact point. We're a more diverse country to start with now. Things have gotten better. I'm not saying things are perfect because, you know, there are still some young African-American sportscasters out there, or just in the news period, that still feel like they're being told to change whatever it is, maybe a hairstyle, maybe certain cultural references or whatever. But yeah, it's totally different from when I started 20 years ago. I got to thank God for Stu Scott once again, because he was on that national level, and because he didn't acquiesce to some people's requests. And I understand he also had to go through it when he was at ESPN as well, that he maintained true to being himself. And it inspired me to be true to myself, because I had that conversation with him, and I had the same question that you just asked me. And basically Stu just told me, F him, you know, just be you. As long as you know you're being yourself, be yourself. Now it's totally different, man, because the world has changed. I mean, you know, not just having a black president, but you look at the internet, Twitter, YouTube, all the cable channels out there. People are starting to know more about one another. So you get the cultural references. So if I did a Dave Chappelle reference 10, 15 years ago, some people might not have been able to get it, but, you know, I know but when Chappelle became very popular and everybody started watching the show, then, of course, it just became part of everybody's lexicon.
Yeah.
So it's totally different now. I know it's not 100%. It's not perfect, but it's better, and it still needs to get even better. And hopefully by me continuing to do what I'm doing, and younger broadcasters coming up through the ranks continue to do what they do, it will become perfect one day, where I'm not looked at, or anybody of color is looked at as a black sportscaster, or Jemele Hill's of the world is looked at as a female sportscaster. We're just known as a sportscaster or a broadcaster, period.
You're listening to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. The guest is FS1's Mike Hill. Take a break, pay some bills. Be back after this. I want to tell everybody about the best new way to find an amazing deal on football tickets. It's called the SeatGeek app. And when you use our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, you'll get $20 off your first ticket purchase. Now, if you want to go to a great college football game, great pro football game, concerts out there, the SeatGeek app takes less than a minute to download, and it's free on iPhone and Android smartphones. SeatGeek does a ton of things that other ticketing sites don't. They aggregate from big ticket sites, so just like when you search for flights and hotels online, SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers, creates a one-stop shop for sports and concert tickets. When you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket option available for that game, all on one page. No need to go anywhere else. SeatGeek, of course, has the Deal Score feature that ranks every ticket on the market from with a 1 to 100 value score, plots the best deals on a color-coded interactive map of the venue, so you can easily identify the best ticket values in the building at a glance. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. On SeatGeek, you can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you can complete the purchase with just two quick taps. There's no faster way to buy tickets. So, to redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, enter promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. If you want to go see the NFL, college football, or the best concerts, use the SeatGeek app, enter our code MEDIA to save $20. All right, back with Mike Hill of FS1. And Mike, you are the host of America's Pregame. I know you have sort of co-hosts as well floating in, different people who, Molly McGrath generally is with you, but I've seen Julie Stewart Binks, et cetera. So, you know, that show, it centers around you, but you have co-hosts every now and then. It's interesting to me, people who do daily television in sports, you've done daily radio. I don't think the public knows just how much work goes into being on the air on a daily basis. But it's interesting. And one of the things we've done on this podcast is we've asked people to be as specific as possible to give us like their work week and give the listeners a sense of what they do before the show, after the show, et cetera. So let's just start like for you. It's Monday, the beginning of the week. You're hosting five America's pregame shows. Can you take us through, you know, when you get up, what you do when you get up, through the show and then after the show?
Well, my week begins on Saturday. So my work week begins the day I get off on that Friday. I start Saturday because I'm watching the game. I'm a big time fan anyway. So I'm watching whatever games are relevant on that Saturday, or I'm keeping abreast of what's going on. Sunday's doing the same thing. Sunday night, I'm reading as much as I can. I'm looking at, you know, Yahoo Sports. I'm looking at CBS Sports. I'm looking at Fox, of course. I'm looking at ESPN. I'm reading Sports Illustrated. I'm reading all the articles. I read your column at night just to kind of get an idea, because you put out a good sports columns to read or whatnot.
That's going to help you with your career, Mike. But keep going.
Seriously, I do. I read as much as I can, and that's what I don't think a lot of people realize, that you got to load your brain up with as much knowledge as possible, because you have to be prepared. On my show, on America's Pregame, because it's not a sports-specific show, we do every single sport that's out there. If you can think about it, we've done cycling. We've done, of course, we do a lot of soccer. We do UFC. We do, of course, the major sports in the NFL, college football, all that, et cetera. So you got to have a knowledge base of every one of them. I'm not saying I'm an expert at every one of them. I might be an expert in NFL and NBA, because those are the sports that I really love. College football, the same thing. But you have to have a base for everything. So when I wake up on Monday morning, before I go into my meeting, I get up. First thing I do, believe it or not, I look at Twitter. I look at Twitter because I want to find out what's going on.
Yeah.
I want to find out what people are talking about in the world. I look at Twitter. I say, oh, man, when I woke up this morning, man, Yogi Berra died. I can't believe that. And I know this is on, we're taping this on Wednesday.
Right.
Is it Wednesday? Yeah, yep. Wednesday. Yogi Berra died. And I'm tripping. So, so next thing you know, I'm going to all the sports websites, talking and trying to find out as much information I know. I'm a Yankees fan, of course, so I want to see what people are saying about Yogi Berra. So I'm reading, I'm doing that, I'm watching the other sports shows that come on television. Now, look, I'll admit, you know, I worked at ESPN, I worked for Fox Sports 1, FS1 now. But I'll turn on ESPN in the morning because they got fresh shows early in the morning. And I think FS1, hopefully our morning programming picks up a little bit more, so we have those live shows. I know we got Colin now, but, you know, I'll start watching anything I can to kind of get my mind prepared for what we're going to talk about. My staff has a morning meeting at 8:45. I get in there around 10-something, and we go in there. We have our meeting. We have a talent rundown meeting. And the producer, along with CP and the segment producers, they'll go over everything that we're going to do in that show. And so they'll ask me my thoughts. They'll ask me what I feel like I can add to the show, what I want to ask certain guests who come on the show. And now that the show is kind of evolving and changing a little bit more, it's becoming more conversational, more debatable, you know, what I feel strongly about. We'll do that, get into it. We'll argue back and forth about a couple of things. And then as soon as that's over, I'll get right to work. I'll start writing as much as I can, even though we have writers on the show. But I want to put certain things in my own terms, my own words. And then I'll do as much preparation or research as I can. So we get a researcher and I go in and talk to him and I'll tell that or her and I'll tell that person, this is what I want information on. So I'll be prepared for the show. Then, of course, you know, after you do all that stuff, you go get your wardrobe, makeup, go upstairs. You tape a couple of things before the show begins that's going to run after the show or run on some regional networks. And then you just get into the show and you do your thing, man. When the light comes on, you just got to shine. So everything, you know, John Wooden has one of my favorite quotes, you know, failing to prepare is preparing to fail. So if I don't prepare for that show, man, I'm going to look lost. You know, you can go out there with all the sports knowledge that you think you have in the world, but when things change or if somebody asks you, you know, you're asking a question to somebody and they kind of flip it on you and you're not prepared, then you're going to look dumb. It's happened to all of us. So the main thing is to make sure that when you go out there, you're armed, you're over-prepared. Now, you don't want to overload your brain because, you know, you obviously can't remember all that stuff and you're not going to be able to regurgitate everything and you'll find yourself talking too fast trying to get all this information out. So you go with the relevant facts. You go with the things that really you think is going to matter for that particular segment. And then, but you also have, you know, your clips on the side just in case you have to reload. So you just do that. And after the show's over, you got a couple more tapings and you go home and you do it all over the next day.
Mike, what's the, in on a day-to-day basis, what's the toughest part for you when you are on the air? What's the toughest thing that that you have to do for those 2 hours?
The toughest part that I have to do while I'm on the air is keep my energy up. I'm a high-energy person. I just want people to be entertained. I want people to enjoy watching what I'm putting on the air. I always call myself an infotainer because I want to give you the information, but I also want to entertain you because I think part of the television, you know, viewing pleasure is being entertained. I mean, you can read, you can go to ESPN.com and read anything you want to. You can go to the .coms and see the digital pages or whatever. You can do all that. So how am I presenting this to you in an entertaining fashion so that you can maintain the information, but at the same time make it memorable? And part of that has to do with my energy. So, you know, I get tired a lot. I work a lot. I do other things. I got a production company, whatever, and I got to deal with some issues outside of the job. But how do I maintain that energy, especially when we first started the show where I was standing all the time and I had just coming off Achilles surgery the first year of the show and trying to keep that energy. So really that to me is the hardest part of anything I had to do over at FS1.
This question obviously could be answered by your executives, your producers, but I'll ask you obviously because ultimately it's your face and your name on the show. But it's very tough to find traction at the hour that you appear on, you know, whether it's 4 to 6 Eastern time or wherever it appears throughout the country, against not just the ESPNs of the world, but against, you know, local news and other things. So how do you, you're still at essentially a very fledgling network. It's only been there for a couple of years. You're going against the established leader at ESPN, which has shows like Pardon the Interruption, which, you know, have been on for 15 years and Around the Horn, et cetera. Whether you think those shows are good or not, it's not really the point. They're established, and it's very hard to knock off the establishment. So how have you and that staff tried to approach getting people to make the investment and turn off whatever they're watching to turn on FS1?
It's simple for me. And yeah, I think it's a better question for the executives over there, but just do your job, man. Bottom line is, you know, you can't control what people watch. If you do your job and you put out that memorable program, you get people talking about something somebody said on your air, then people will start watching. You know, it's just the brand recognition. I think having Jamie Horowitz over there, and I can't say this enough. And I, you know, that guy to me is as talented as anybody that anybody ever wants to know in this business, seriously. When I was at ESPN with him, I stopped wanting to do SportsCenter because I wanted to be a part of what he had. Hmm. And I'm not blowing smoke up his butt. You know, Jamie knows this. You know, I'm so – this is not me kissing anybody's ass because anybody knows me. I don't do any ass kissing whatsoever. I probably don't do enough of it. Maybe that would have helped me in my damn career.
That's funny.
But the problem is the issue that we have over there is that, yes, it is a fledgling network, and it is going up against this big-ass beast that ESPN has been there and that's been established in a paradigm that people have with it. When you wake up in the morning, you go to sleep at night, people see ESPN. 2.5 years later, I left 2.5 years ago. I swear, man, I still get people on a weekly basis, at least 5 or 6 people coming up to me and say, man, SportsCenter, I watch SportsCenter every night. I like you on ESPN. I ain't been there in 2.5 years.
It's fine.
Now, that says something about their brand.
Yep.
And it's flattering because you still remember me from ESPN 2.5 years ago. But maybe you see me on Fox and you don't realize that you're not watching ESPN, but you're watching Fox. You just see a familiar face that you saw on ESPN. So trying to get people to come over, once again, as long as we do our job and as long as Jamie goes in there and cooks the way I know he's going to cook, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. I really have the faith that one day FS1, hopefully I'm around, is going to take over for ESPN. It's not going to happen in the next couple of months. It's not going to happen maybe in a year or two or whatever. But soon, the tide is going to change, man. And just like CNN and Fox News Channel, it's going to change the same way. I guarantee it. I really feel that way. I feel that strongly about it.
If you, you know, let's say you continue at FS1 heading forward, are there other things there that you would like to do beyond the show that you're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, I think now I want my role to change a little bit. I think now because I do have an opinion, as you can tell on Twitter, I'm very opinionated. I say what's on my mind. I would like to be more, and I know how you feel about Skip, so Stephen A or whatever, so I want to say it that way.
You can say whatever you want, like Mike. It's your podcast.
I like and admire those guys. Don't get me wrong. So the thing is, like, I like giving my opinion. So I would like to kind of be more of an opponent role, or maybe like a Michael Smith role, Michael Smith and Jemele Hill's role, where they're still hosting the show, but they're more pundits. They're giving their opinions or whatever, and they're more, not necessarily debate, but having a conversation, having a very smart conversation that if it becomes a debate, you're armed with the knowledge that you need to go in there and have that verbal sparring rule or war. So I would like to do more things like that. You know, I told you I got a production company, so I'm doing a lot of things behind the scenes as well, producing some shows or whatever. So, and I also have show ideas. I was on the phone with Jamie earlier today and shooting out an idea that I have for a show that hopefully we can bring to fruition. So, you know, I'm just happy, man. I know that's not the answer you're looking for, but yeah, I'm happy at whatever role Jamie wants to see me in, man, puts me in. You know, like I told him today, you know, he's the general, I'm the colonel, just let me know what my marching orders are and I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, I'm not looking for any answer. I'm looking for honesty and this isn't China Central Television, Mike. We're not gonna edit out that love you just gave for Stephen A and Skip. You'll hear this on Friday. As much as it's gonna pain me to hear that again, I'm leaving it in.
are my guys, man. I love Stephen A and Skip, man. Skip was really nice to you when I was there. We butt heads one time. We almost went to blows one time. I'll tell you about that another day.
Ooh, yeah. He's listening, and I just read in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, the one thing I'll say about Bayless is he's in incredible shape. The guy is a physical specimen, certainly.
Let me tell you something right now. People can run up on Skip all they want to. Skip might be a little older, but I don't think you want to run up on Skip.
No.
Skip is one of those guys that's a physical specimen, but he is really a nice guy, and he is one of those guys that – What I respect about him is that even though some of the shit that comes out of his mouth might be crazy, and you might like, oh my God, no, he didn't just say that. He actually believes it. It's not an act. It's not a shtick. It's who he is. And for that, I have to respect it.
All right, Mike, you're pushing it, Mike. I really don't want to cut any of this, but all right. The last thing I want to get to you, and you mentioned this before, you have a entertainment production company.
Yeah.
I think it's is it Thrill of Entertainment? Is that the name of the production company?
Yeah, Thrill of Entertainment.
Okay, so right, you're doing multimedia production for TV, for the web. You know, in looking at your background too, you've acted before. So, you know, I saw that it's on the Fox bio that you were in an off-Broadway production of Miss Evers' Boys. So listen, it's obvious that drama and entertainment is part of your background and perhaps part of your future. So what are the goals for this production company? Is it your hope that you branch away from sports to do non-sports kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, well, I was telling my agent the other day that my whole goal is to stay at FS1 for another 15, 20 years, hopefully, if they'll have me around. I would love to be there, still be on the air in that capacity, doing some hosting outside of that, maybe in a different capacity, maybe like a view type show for men. But behind the scenes, man, I want to produce content. I'm doing something right now called Beyond the Mic, where I'm getting stories from comedians. Half of my friends are comedians, and we're just telling their stories about things that happen off stage. And they're very funny storytellers, as you may know. But just getting those life experiences of these comedians off stage. So I'm in post-production for that, doing content, writing concepts for TV shows and things like that. I also got another talk show that I want to try and bring in development that I've been talking to a couple of people about, a couple of third-party production companies. So one thing I want to do, man, is I look at people like Ryan Seacrest, and I admire him. So, you know, you may have gotten a name for being in front of the camera, but you become a boss behind the camera, and I'm trying to become a boss behind the camera. I'm trying to make an impact. So hopefully, God's will, it'll be done. So I'm just trying to bring thrill of entertainment to as many people as possible and trying to make it as big as possible.
That's interesting. How, and I'm just curious about this because it's obviously not my world, but how difficult or easy is it to try to make or get a break into the entertainment world, even for someone like you who obviously has inroads in at Fox, which is a big company? I mean, do you find that there are avenues you can go, or do you gotta hustle in that world as if you're just starting out, like a 21-year-old would be just starting out in sports?
A little bit all over again. It's funny you asked me that question. I was thinking about that the other day, because when I first got out here to L.A., man, I mean, I've done a lot of entertainment. So I did Entertainment Tonight. I've done Good Day L.A. So, you know, I've gotten opportunities in front of the camera doing things like that. When I go in these general meetings a lot of times, and this is where, you know, the whole thing about starting all over again, sometimes it feels like, you know, you have to prove yourself again. Now, I've been in front of the camera 20 years, and I've been doing sports, and I've done some entertainment stuff. I did this web series with Jay Harris called Both Sides of the Ball,
right?
Where it was like, you know, I don't know if you ever saw that before.
Yeah, I remember the name of that,
Yeah, Both Sides of the Ball. We had a lot of fun doing that. But people still see you as a sportscaster, and they pigeonhole you, and they put you in that stereotype. And so when you meet people, they're like, well, we don't really have any sports thing going on or whatever. Like, well, no, I'm more than just a sportscaster. And that's the part that I'm trying to overcome out here. Now, I've been successful. I've had a lot of opportunities. I've had some growth, and I've seen, you know, people who gotten to know me a little bit better outside of the sports market. But still, just like you're starting off as a broadcaster in news or sports, you know how you go to that market 196 and they need 2 years of experience?
Right.
Well, where the hell are you going to get 2 years of experience if it ain't market 196,
right?
You know what I mean? So it's like, I need to get that, you know, the breaks and in the entertainment market, entertainment world, so they can see me in that capacity in order to get more opportunities. And so that's a hard part right now. And I've had it better than others, man, but it's still a struggle. And but I'll get there. I'll keep it safe.
Yeah, we wish you luck on that. Here's the last one for me, Mike. And that is you've lived in different parts of the country, which I think makes you a more well-rounded person and I think probably able to communicate with different types of people. But in particular, you've been a big part of East Coast media while working at ESPN and a big part of the West Coast media, obviously now at FS1. What, just as a sort of as a general question, what are the differences, if there are differences, between how West Coast media does its job or thinks of sports and thinks of however they think of this profession of ours versus how they do on the East Coast? Because I think there's always a perception that, you know, things are more intense on the East Coast. Competition is harder. You look at papers in, like, New York and Philly, and it's dog-eat-dog world. Where in Los Angeles,
yeah,
there's so many other things to do that it's not that – I'm not saying it's not taken seriously, but the perspective is a little bit different. Is that stereotype real, and if so, how?
It's real. It is not a stereotype. Having worked in New York, having worked in L.A., totally different, man. The stress level in New York, the intensity, the attitudes. And I love New York. I love that energy, man. I was born in New York. That's always going to be home for me. I feel like I'm an East Coast guy. But at the same time, man, oh, gosh, to be out here at this age and to be relaxed and not to have that stress and the pressure, man, it's more laid back. It's like, oh, that happened. Okay, well, we'll deal with it next time. Out there, man, it's the end of the world. It's Armageddon.
Right.
So, yes, it is totally different, man. So, yes, I'm an East Coast guy, but I am so happy to be on the West Coast because as a black man with cholesterol issues and high blood pressure, I can't take it out there. I can't take it anymore, man. I need to stay on the West Coast where I'm going to die a peaceful death, my brother. It's totally different.
I love how Mike Hill says this as in like 2 hours, I got to take the number one trade and get jostled on the top of my head for 50 blocks. Mike, where did you grow up? Where did you grow up in the Bronx?
Right across the street from Yankee Stadium, 158th Street in Girard.
Wow.
I mean, directly across from the old Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, yeah.
New Yankee Stadium, California, yeah.
And that, you know, that area actually, you know, in the old days, if like in the 70s and the 80s, people were like all afraid to go to Yankee Stadium before and after games. But now, a lot of restaurants there, that area, mm-hmm. that stretch is turned around a little bit. You see people hanging out there after Yankee games, which is pretty cool.
Oh, man, the 70s, 80s, and the 90s, and a lot of the 2000s, until they built the new stadium. That's
exactly.
When things started changing. Now they got a Target over there. I'm over there like, there's a Target over here?
Right.
They got a Target, they got a mall, they got Applebee's.
It's like Des Moines, Iowa totally now, basically. It's not the Bronx.
Exactly.
All right, Mike Hill of FS1. Don't say Fox Sports 1. Say FS1.
Yeah. FS1, new brand, baby. We
new brand.
Yeah, own brand.
More Jamie Horowitz stuff. FS1 is Mike Hill's employer. He is the host of America's Pregame. You've also seen him for many, many years on ESPN, from Hill and Schlereth to SportsCenter to everything he's done. I admire that he speaks his mind. You should follow him on Twitter at It's Mike Hill. He's a good follow. And again, he's a person in the business who is unafraid and unapologetic about what he feels, and the business needs more people like that, in my opinion. Mike, I'm really glad we had a chance to do this. I've been looking forward to it, and I really appreciate you giving us some time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thank you very much.
Man, it is my honor, my pleasure, man. Much respect to you and everything you do, my brother, really.
Thanks, Mike. Take care of yourself.
All right, Rich. Take care, man.
All right, we're heading to the NFL's Week 3. Fascinating stuff going on. We'll see how the Cowboys do with Tony Romo's injury. Can the Seahawks rebound? And are the Redskins for real? It seems like everybody is playing fantasy football, pretty much because they are. You don't want to miss out. Now, with FanDuel, you can play with up to $200 in bonus cash with our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. You've probably heard of FanDuel somewhere before. Here's what it's all about. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay over $75 million a week this football season. You know, a lot of people love fantasy football, but fans miss out because the whole season is just too much for a time commitment. FanDuel does away with all that. You can draft a team at any time, drop into tournaments for weekly cash prizes. Entry fees start at just $1. There's a league for everyone. NFL games are already live in the FanDuel lobby, so you don't have to wait another day to start building your teams. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. So go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 media people that use my code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, so don't get left out. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Check it out today. All right, and as we switch from Mike Hill, we now bring in Wayne Coffey, one of the great sports writers in this country, formerly of the Daily News, and that will be part of our discussion point in this podcast. Wayne Coffey joins us from New York City. Wayne, thanks so much for jumping on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Happy to be with you, Richard.
All right, Wayne, as you know, people who listen to this podcast, they obviously have an interest in the sports media, and many of them will know that the Daily News laid off 12 people in the sports department over the last 2 weeks. Some very, very big names: Flip Bondi, sports editor Terry Thompson, Bill Madden is a Hall of Fame baseball writer, Hank Gola, longtime football writer, golf writer, and yourself. You know, I've tweeted this out, I've written it. It's, you know, seemingly unfathomable to see very, very talented people lose their job, especially when, if you're going to sort of head for a digital first future, you should want talented people who are fast writers, smart writers, excellent reporters as part of that future. So that's the setup for you coming on this podcast, and I appreciate you coming on because it's not an easy topic to talk about. But if nothing else, I think some people in the business can learn about the realities of the business. So my first question for you, Wayne, is how much of this was a surprise and how did you learn about it?
It could not have been more of a surprise, Richard. Maybe that speaks to my own naivete. I mean, you know, and I know, and I'm sure most of our listeners know that these are not exactly the halcyon days of newspapers in America. And there's dwindling circulation, and ad pages are down, and the financial picture is bleak and seemingly getting bleaker in a lot of sectors of the market. But all of that said, I just never saw this coming. In fact, I had just celebrated 12 days earlier. I had celebrated my 30th anniversary at the Daily News, and
wow.
It's where I've grown up, most literally and figuratively, as a journalist. It's a place that I love. It's a New York institution, and I just really did not see it coming until Wednesday, September 16th, right around noon, when I got a call from the sports editor, Bill Price, who was his role that day. And I have a wonderful relationship with Bill and think the world of him. But he had he probably had the worst job in America that day because he was the executioner. Hmm. And he had not only had to do it with me, but as you said, the list of colleagues and really some top-notch people and top-notch journalists who were also shown the door on that Black Wednesday.
Wayne, do you have a sense as to why this happened in terms of, do you think it was a targeted group of people who were longtime employees, which means high salaries, which means that if you have to sort of cut a certain number, you go for the people who are making the most money? Because in my mind, and I'm only going to, let's say, speak for you at the moment, it wasn't merit-based. I mean, you literally had broken the James Blake story, whatever it was, 3 days earlier, one of the biggest stories in New York City, James Blake getting essentially roughed up by the NYPD. So it could, to me at least, on face, it could not have been merit. Have you come up with any kind of sort of thought as to why you think specifically you were targeted?
I really haven't, Richard. I have no reason to believe that it was merit-based. I think, honestly, not to sound boastful, but I mean, the feedback that I had gotten, not just recently, but really over years and years and even decades, I'd never heard anything but, you know, mostly nice things. And, you know, I'm no more perfect than anyone else. There was not even the slightest inkling. And I can speak for some of my colleagues. I know Philip Bondi didn't see it coming, not Hank Gola, and Terry Thompson, who was the assistant managing editor for sports and the head of the Daily News I-team, and just a great person and phenomenal journalist, was also shown the door on the same day. And I think most of the people, not all, but most of the people who were sent on their way were experienced. So does it begin and end with a salary dump? I think that was a major consideration. When I asked, I was just told that it was a reorganization. And, one of the people in human resources said, look, we're long past the point where we're talking about, kind of cutting away the fat. There is no fat. It's lean and getting ominously leaner all the time. And so I think, I really think it speaks to the financial situation and the increasingly perilous state that the paper seems to be in, with circulation numbers going down, and even with web traffic supposedly up, the Daily News and a lot of other papers have always long had a difficult time figuring out a reliable way to monetize the internet. So, I think it came down to dollars and cents, and really nothing more than that. And perhaps with a sale possibly imminent of the paper, maybe they were just thinking, well, it's going to be a lot more attractive to a buyer if we lop off a few heads.
Is there anything that you think the Daily News could have done in the last, let's say, 5 years to have avoided what happened on that Wednesday?
That's an excellent question, Richard. I'm not sure that I have I'm even qualified to kind of offer a master plan. I do think I'm old friends and Olympic buddies with Jerry Longman, a wonderful writer for the New York Times, and Jerry once said, his kind of long-running lament in the newspaper industry is that we're the only business that when it's losing readers and looting interest, we decide we're going to make the product worse by firing a bunch of people,
right,
and that's going to turn it around. And, what I will say is that it seems to me that what the Daily News has been doing is not working, and I don't think that can really even be disputed. It's, and I don't say that at all as a bitter ex-employee, because the truth is that I am not bitter. I mean, I'm not happy. It was a jolt. It was a painful time, and tears were shed. But it was mostly those feelings were about just leaving colleagues who I really respect and admire and like and enjoyed working with and being part of what has historically been a really first-rate sports section. And it's, so all of that was good, but I have a lot of so many blessings in my life and positive things going on that, I really feel that it's going to be fine. But I guess I know I digress here, but I can't say that I know what should have been done differently, but I do think that Jerry's point is central here, and that is the answer is not to make the editorial product worse and worse. It's not to just lop heads and then and rewrite wires and not have anything original and anything fresh and not tell and find compelling stories. I mean, to me, that's what newspapers should be about. And I think when you have really great content, I think, and no matter what the delivery system, when you have great content, I think people are going to seek it out. And I really believe that to the core of my being.
Wayne, how was it, how did you feel that the Daily News handled the after, when you were told that you were being laid off, how did you feel they handled whatever the time was after that? Were you immediately told to leave the newsroom? Were you given a couple of days to get your things and contacts together? I think people, especially young people in the business, I think could learn something from how the Daily News handled it, either positively or negatively.
Well, it could hardly have been more abrupt. I got the call Wednesday at noon, and again, this is after 30 years, and my last work day was Friday, two days later. And they told me that I didn't have to work the rest of the week. And but my email was turned off within an hour or two. The American Express card was canceled. I don't know if they thought I was going to go on a spending spree.
Right.
Now I was responsible for it anyway, so it wouldn't have been on it wouldn't have been on Mort Zuckerman's would have diminished his net worth. But you know, I wasn't in the office, so it's not like I've heard stories about people getting marched to the door by surrounded by security people. I mean, that did not happen to me. I was very rarely went in the office, so I had nothing to collect and no goodbyes to say, at least in that moment. I was out of the office and got a phone call. So, I mean, someone said, "Oh God, how could they have done it on the phone? You know, that's terribly inhumane." You know, I don't see that as a huge issue. I mean, really, if I had been summoned to the office, you know, to hear it in person, I don't think it would have been any more palatable or enjoyable. So, I mean, it was abrupt. It was pretty harsh. And then right after I was told that I was on the hit list, the phone went in to hand it off to the human resources fellow. And then I started getting the ugly nitty gritty about COBRA and how to apply for unemployment and the whole deal. But it's, I mean, listen, I'm not sugarcoating it. It wasn't pretty, but I'm not sure there's any pretty way to deliver that kind of news.
Yeah, I appreciate you answering that. And, you know, none of us are naive in American business in 2015, although the idea of getting your email shut off now is cold. And, you know, this is where I, especially the newspaper business and some other media organizations, really do not have good reputations when it comes to handling this. My last one on this, Wayne, before I sort of ask you, I want to sort of look heading forward for you. Did the Daily News sports writers, was there any kind of union? And did they tell you how to act in a certain way after the news came down?
No, there is no union. There had years ago, there had been the newsroom employees were represented by the Newspaper Guild. In one of the, it was the, I believe, the Tribune Company, which is obviously front and center in the media news now with much the wholesale gutting of the Los Angeles Times. Yeah. The Tribune Company broke the union, and so there really was nothing, you know, no protection afforded that way, and no recourse there. So no, there were no. You know, no one said, you know, don't be publicly critical, don't do this, that, or the other thing. We were just kind of, left on our own. And that was, you know, that was pretty much it.
How do you feel about the employees in the sports department in particular that are currently working there today? Do you think are we going to see a repeat of this 5 months from now, 3 months from now, or is there a possibility their jobs are relatively safe?
I really don't know. I'd be guessing, Richard. I think that, again, the larger picture has been so ominous for so long that it's hard to believe that they think, you know, okay, we're good now. We're going to be stable, and then we're going to start adding people in a year or three or five. I'd love if that were the case. I mean, there are a number of people who I have the highest possible regard for. Just tremendous people and journalists who really care about doing great work and honoring the craft of journalism. But I don't think I would feel particularly safe just because I think that it's, again, the larger picture is just not terribly rosy. And I'd love to see that, you know, maybe, you know, if the paper is sold, there's an infusion of money. But, you know, I don't know. I know there has been, you know, there's been at least some kind of discussion about ultimately the Daily News possibly being web only,
right,
as some other newspapers have done. And I don't know if that's the direction it's going in. I don't know if they're going to feel like they can, you know, they can put it out, you know, have the logo and have, you know, 10 or 20 people kind of doing the, you know, holding, manning all the oars. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be comfortable saying that it's the Home Office for Job Security right now.
All right, Wayne. So as we look forward, you have a long career at the Daily News. You've won a lot of awards. You've written books. Your reputation in the business is excellent. At the same time, it's a tough business. There's not always a ton of jobs. There's a tendency to hire young people at very low salaries to get a lot of work out of them. So understanding that it's only been a couple of days since the layoffs, one, what would you like to do heading forward? And two, what kind of outreach have you gotten so far from other people in potentially hiring situations?
Well, it is really early yet, and I've been I've got a book coming out next month with that I collaborated with Urban Meyer with, called Above the Line: Lessons in Leadership and Life from a Championship Season. That's being published by Penguin, and there are very high hopes for that. I think it's a valuable book, and as Urban said, he wanted this to be a game changer in among leadership books, and he's very passionate about it, got a lot of things to say about it, and I think pro football fans and others and leadership fans, they'll get a real insight into how this guy's mind works. And so that's something that I feel good about. I've actually just started working on a book with Carly Lloyd of World Cup fame.
Nice.
And that I'm really excited about. And I think, you know, books are, I've had, been fortunate to have quite a bit of success with the recent books I've done with Ari Dickey and Mariana Rivera and on the 1980 Olympic hockey team. And so, and I love writing books and I love telling long form stories. So I think I'll be doing a lot of that. But I also just, you know, I love daily journalism, and I have a freelance piece I'm working on right now for USA Today. I've spoken with the New York Times. I've put out some preliminary feelers elsewhere, and if there's a quote unquote regular job that turns up, I mean, I'd absolutely love to explore it. And if not, I really believe that things are going to be fine. And I think, you know, I was telling someone recently, Richard, it's not to sound preachy or high-handed here, but, you know, one of an old therapist friend of my wife's and I once said, you are what you pay attention to. And right now, you know, in my mind, I mean, what happened, what's going on at the Daily News, that place is, you know, is pretty much of a swamp. And what happened was not pleasant, but I really am not inclined to dwell on that. It's happened, and now I want to turn my attention to things that are more positive and the blessings that I do have, opportunities that I have, and really try to, you know, make the best of it going forward. I feel like I'm like channeling my inner Belichick here, saying, you know, we're focused on. You know, we're focused on our next game now. Don't ask me about the last game. Right. But, you know, in a sense, there's, you know, there's a lot of wisdom inherent in living that way and thinking that way.
We're on to Cincinnati, as Belichick would say.
We're on to Cincinnati. There we go.
So, you know, I want to get to the finish up on the Meyer book because, again, you've had success with the Ari Dickey book, which was fantastic, Mariano's book. I didn't know you were doing Carly Lloyd's book, which is not an insignificant book for sure, so that's great. And then obviously the Urban Meyer book, Above the Line: Lessons in Leadership and Life from a Championship Season, that comes out in October. I hope for your sake Urban does a lot of publicity, because that obviously is the game changer usually when the subject is willing to go out there and talk up the book in different spots, especially in Columbus. Have you found, Wayne, that let's forget about the sort of the day-to-day satisfaction of working in news, and I don't necessarily want you to give me any dollar figures, but can one be a sports author in the way you are a sports author, working with very well-known people, and have a comparable income doing that, a comparable income to working for a very big city newspaper in sports? Or is it essentially along the same financial lines, or maybe that's even more lucrative? So without giving your actual dollars away, for people who might be interested in that, is that a good professional option to head into?
Yeah, I think it can be, Richard. Books can be a little bit feast or famine, so to say. There are the things, and listen, we love to have regular paychecks and full package of benefits as part of our work life. So, if you get let's say you work on a book that's a pretty big project, and and the writer's share of it is in six figures. I mean, that's not an inconsiderable amount, and depending on the nature of the project, it may take, it could take a half a year, or it could take a year or more. So you've got to kind of stretch that out. You've also got to remember those your quarterly payments to your friends at the IRS. I mean, it's a whole different gig for sure. I wouldn't necessarily say to a young person, yeah, I'm just going to go write books and make a go of it. I mean, there are absolutely people who do it. And if you have a project that takes off and does well, the royalties can be considerable, and you can, like the R.A. Dickey book, not only was a New York Times bestseller, but it's been optioned to be a feature film. The option has been picked up. It looks like it may be going ahead as a feature film. So, I mean, if that were to happen, those are not small potatoes.
Right.
I just really believe that if someone is industrious and has integrity and works hard at it and really is committed to finding stories to tell, whether they're being told over 1,000 or 2,000 words or 80,000 words in book form, I really want to believe that there's always going to place for your work. I really love writing books, and it's been a great outlet for me. And now, who knows, it may end up becoming the main event. But it's a whole different, it's a different endeavor altogether when, making it your full livelihood.
All right. Again, the book that Wayne has coming out is a book he co-wrote with Ohio State football coach Urban Meyer. The book is Above the Line: Lessons in Leadership and Life from a Championship Season. These books that sort of are about from coaches with a lot of sort of respect and success, like Rick Pitino and Pat Riley, they've generally speaking done very, very well. So Wayne, that sounds like a book that may really hit. And again, Wayne, I will just leave you with this. There's a lot of people, really talented people at the Daily News who lost their jobs, so I hope the best for them. I hope we see your byline and Flip Bondi. Terry Thompson is someone who's associated with Sports Illustrated, given her husband worked here for many, many years. So the hope is that people will find some new avenues. And, oftentimes in journalism, interestingly enough, sometimes like when one door closes, even that a door that you didn't expect to close leads to a very, very better place. So I think for many of you, interestingly enough, my sense is like a year or two from now, you're probably going to be in a better place than you were a couple months ago.
I would like to think so. And I think, I'm probably, it's a little bit late in the game for me to reinvent myself as any sort of a talk show host or shock jock or, spouting inflammatory opinions at high volume.
Hot take, Wayne. That's where the future is. Come on. I know you have it in you.
Well, I don't know. Should I start screaming and yelling right now and maybe,
If you're gonna scream, if you're gonna scream,
using some profanity, maybe.
I would say if you're gonna scream and yell, do it on a podcast or an outlet that has far more listeners than this one.
Oh, come on, don't down yourself, Richard. Come on. So I don't think I'm going to be going that route. But I really trust. I trust that it'll be fine. I trust that there's a plan, and I feel grateful. I mean, the Daily News really gave me a great opportunity, and the one thing that I love and that I've always really cherished is having some creative freedom. You know, I wasn't, except for very early on in my time at the paper, I was never really tethered to a beat per se. So I was, you know, I was free to go find stories and tell. I mean, the passing of Yogi Berra just reminded me of just when his wife Carmen passed, I think it was just a little over a year ago. I went to the service and just went and talked to people who knew her and knew the Berras in Montclair, New Jersey, and just sort of told the story of their lives and their impact on their community from the perspective of people who no one's ever heard of and just who intersected them, you know, whether it was in church or at the little corner newsstand or a coffee shop. And, you know, those are the kind of stories that I love to tell, that, you know, things there, you know, kind of slices of real life and real people who every single one of us interacts with every day. And I think there'll be opportunities to keep doing that. So.
Well, Wayne, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. These are not easy topics to discuss for the individual who this happened to. So I have I wish you nothing but continued success. You're an incredibly talented guy. There's a lot of people who are going to listen to this podcast who are familiar with your work and will follow you wherever you end up. So once again, thanks for coming on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I appreciate it.
Okay, Richard. Thank you.
All right, back in the studio for a very quick wrap-up. My thanks to Mike Hill of FS1, no longer calling it Fox Sports 1, FS1, and Wayne Coffey of the Daily News, who was really kind enough to give some, just to get into the experience of what it's like to be laid off, which, you know, obviously, it's probably going to happen to all of us, and it's not a very pleasant situation, but I thought that was very cool of him to be honest and open, and that's part of the business, and people should hear about it. Bet two different interviews, but both
you can say that
yeah,
again.
No kidding. But both very interesting. Mike Hill totally gives you a sense of who he is and how he wanted to be changed. The idea that someone in talent comes to him and says, you know, sort of like vanilla it up a little bit. That's insane.
Or but they say you're too urban.
Too urban, which is, you know,
oh,
I mean, you know the code words for that. So I knew Mike Hill would be a good guest, and he delivered. I found him to be an honest guy and an interesting guy, probably underrated. So I hope he has. It's not everything I love at FS1, and my God, did he praise Jamie Horowitz, who I have some issues with. But listen, I the one thing about that network is it is different than ESPN. They do give people a lot more creative freedom on and off the air. It's not like they're handling, you know, for as amazing as ESPN can be, they overmanage their people.
I have to call you out for something. We've had two guests from FS1 on the podcast now. Katie
Carissa?
Nolan.
Three.
Oh, I forgot about Carissa.
Carissa Thompson, right.
Both Katie and Mike Hill have praised Jamie Horowitz.
Right.
So
you think it's maybe on me as opposed to them?
It might be you.
Bet, again, this is the guy who fostered or foisted the embrace debate culture on ESPN.
Yeah, well.
So, I mean, you've seen Harry Potter, right?
I've seen Harry Potter. Right. Are you kidding me?
This is essentially the Voldemort of television. Trust me on this.
All right.
All right, listen. So coming up, Bet, we've got some excellent guests. Israel Gutierrez of ESPN is coming up. Francesca Weems got a great story, Hawaiian reporter. Paul Heyman from the WWE, most famous wrestling manager going today. He is coming up. I think Mike Tirico eventually is going to be on this podcast, Bet, not too long from now. So those are, I think, the people who are coming up on the podcast. Thanks again for listening. Hit Bet and I up on Twitter, Give us your feedback, criticisms, and comments. Our thanks to Slate and Panoply. Our thanks to Sports Illustrated. Bet, is there anyone else I need to thank? I'm just totally riffing here, and it's pretty horrible. I want to thank Bev Marston, who was...
For editing your very long podcast.
Right, who is training also for a marathon and running very fast. We wish her well.
I am training for a marathon.
Yeah, looking good.
DC listeners, I'm running the Marine Corps Marathon on October 25th. Come out and cheer me on.
Cheer her on for all the people who are listening to this podcast. All right, this is Richard Deitch. My thanks to Bev Marston. My thanks to Mike Hill and Wayne Coffey. We'll see you soon on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.